You're listening to the Arctic Circle podcast. In this episode, we listen to Admiral Rob Bauer, chair of NATO Military Committee, speak on NATO's perspective on the Arctic. This event originally took place at the 2023 Arctic Circle Assembly. The speech is followed by a Q&A with the audience, moderated by Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, chairman of Arctic Circle and former president of Iceland.
It's good to see so many people. Good afternoon, and it's good to be back. Ministers, ambassadors, ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to be back in Iceland for the Arctic Circle Assembly. Getting here was a little bit difficult, but with a delay of about 4 hours, the plane was able to leave Amsterdam and arrive here. When I stood here a year ago, I spoke about the impact of Russia's unjust and brutal invasion of Ukraine. And I spoke about how the melting ice in the Arctic connects North America, Asia, and Europe, creating new sea routes that would facilitate the movement of large vessels and shorten navigation times. I spoke about the increased competition and militarization of the Arctic region, especially from Russia and China. A year on, all of these points remain true. The Arctic is still a Russian military stronghold, home to the Northern Fleet, nuclear submarines, missile facilities, airfields, radar stations, and troop concentrations. Russia's largest force is stationed on the Kola Peninsula, which shares a border with Norway and Finland, NATO's newest member. Moscow was rapidly expanding its presence even before the war in Ukraine by building and renovating dozens of military bases in the Arctic. The region is still being used as a test bed for Russian weapons, including hypersonic missiles and the Poseidon nuclear torpedo drone. At their summit in March 2023, both Russia and China agreed to closer cooperation, especially in the areas of Arctic energy and transportation. Both countries are seeking to establish a joint umbrella organization for traffic on the Northern Sea Route. So far, this has translated into a surge of Russian crude oil shipments to Chinese ports through this route. And what experts have deemed reckless behavior, for the first time, Russia has sent the first non-ice class Aframax oil tanker into the Arctic. Russia decided to forgo long-standing practices regarding ice protection in an effort to reroute ever larger amounts of crude oil to China in non-ice class oil tankers, putting profit above security and safety. A Chinese container ship has also completed a 3-month round-trip voyage from the Baltic Sea to China and back. It is the first step in establishing regular, albeit small-scale, container liner service utilizing Russia's Northern Sea Route. We cannot be naive and expect these new routes to solely be used by commercial vessels. In late April, the Russian Coast Guard and the Chinese Coast Guard signed a cooperation agreement to team up to fight terrorism, illegal migration, drug and arms smuggling, as well as illegal fishing. Additionally, Chinese shipyards have been receiving contracts for the construction of Russian ice-capable Arctic tankers. Over the past decade, China has invested more than $19 billion in Arctic energy and mineral projects, primarily in Russia. China is also the biggest investor in the Power of Siberian Pipeline, a $55 billion project that is the largest gas project in the post-Soviet Russian history. Therefore, on the 30th of June, when Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov called China the priority partner to Russia in the Arctic, he was right. And this is concerning to us, Because while Russia's intention in the Arctic have become clearer in the recent years, China's intentions for the region remain opaque. For many years, the Arctic has benefited from cross-border cooperation and peaceful dialogue between nations with an Arctic territorial presence, including Russia. This was done through the Arctic Council, the Barents Euro-Atlantic Cooperation, and the Council of the Baltic Sea States. All three provided a venue for constructive dialogue with Russia under the auspices of regional cooperation, building trust, reducing tension, and tackling common problems. This dialogue and the new structures ushered in an era of quiet cooperation that has been accurately described as high north, low tension. But dialogue and cooperation between regional partners and Russia have been failing. First in the Arctic Council, where dialogue and activities were put on hold since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and have only recently resumed thanks to some guidelines that were approved by all participating nations. Then, with Russia's recent announcement that it is withdrawing from the Barents Euro-Arctic Council, or the BEAC, blaming Western members of effectively paralyzing the Council's activities since March 2022. When dialogue fails, when faced with unpredictable regional actors and seeing more and more activity from adverse entities in the region with unclear intentions, NATO has had no choice but to prepare for the unexpected. If you remember, I started this speech by highlighting what hasn't changed in the region. Let me now highlight what has changed. NATO is more prepared, secure, and united than ever before. We have to prepare for the fact that conflict can present itself at any point, in any domain, including in the Arctic. We have a responsibility to protect all our allies, including the 6, soon to be 7, situated in the Arctic. The alliance has a clear interest in seeing stability, security, and peaceful cooperation in the region. It remains of strategic importance to us. NATO's concept for the deterrence and defense in the Euro-Atlantic area places transatlantic security at the center of NATO's goals. The security of North America is inextricably linked to the security of the Euro-Atlantic area. This is also reflected in our new geographically specific plans that describe how we will defend key and relevant places within our alliance. The regional plan Northwest specifically sees to the Atlantic and the European Arctic. The region falls under the command of the newest Allied Joint Force Command in Norfolk. Joint Force Command Norfolk sees to it that NATO's force posture supports Arctic operations and provides greater Arctic defense coherence. And this ensures that forces and equipment can flow between the continents in conflict and in peace, and protects freedom of navigation. As the gateway to the North Atlantic, the Arctic also hosts vital trade and communication links between North America and Europe. Data is critical to our way of life, so we are looking at ways to secure and protect our undersea cables and airwaves. 1.3 million kilometers of cables enable an estimated 10 trillion US dollars worth of financial transactions every day. Following the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline, and most recently the damage of the Estonian-Finnish pipeline, we have further enhanced our vigilance. NATO has doubled the number of ships patrolling the North and the Baltic Seas and stepped up intelligence sharing. NATO allies also agreed to create an undersea infrastructure cell to map vulnerabilities and coordinate efforts between NATO allies, partners, and the private sector, as well as a specialized maritime center for the security of critical undersea infrastructure within NATO's maritime command. On a national level, allies are also investing in new fighter planes, maritime surveillance aircraft, and ships. Norway, Finland, and Denmark have agreed to increase their defense budgets, in part to purchase more capabilities and equipment, including jets and ships, to better patrol its seas and detect non-allied submarines, including in the Arctic. Our Nordic allies are also looking to work more closely together by integrating some of their defense policies. Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark have agreed to operate their approximately 250 fighter jets as a joint operational fleet and also support air policing over Iceland. Sweden and Finland have announced new military investments to accompany their NATO membership. Closer cooperation between the Nordic nations will improve unity of purpose, but also maximize planning cooperation and their defense plans for the region. NATO and allies have also increased their exercises in the region. We regularly conduct Arctic and anti-submarine exercises to ensure our forces remain ready to operate in all conditions. This year, the Arctic region has played host most prominently to Operation Nanook, the biggest Canadian and US-led exercise in the High North, Special Forces Exercise Adamant Serpent, and Exercise Joint Viking 23. All these exercises allow allied and partner forces to not only train together under extreme conditions and in a harsh environment, but also to test and practice the quick movement of troops, their deployability and sustainability, as well as build interoperability between participating nations. Next year, our four Nordic allies, making it five when Sweden becomes a NATO member, will host Nordic Response, formerly Cold Response, which will fall under the auspices of the exercise Steadfast Defender 24. This exercise will be an important milestone in a common Nordic further integration into NATO and for our new regional plan, Northwest. These are but a few examples of how NATO and allies are increasing our presence and vigilance across the alliance, including in the High North. So while NATO remains a defensive alliance with ambitions to prevent conflict and ensure tensions remain low in the High North, in the current security environment, this has necessitated a firmer response from NATO. As a defensive alliance, we have to prepare for the fact that the Russian threat can also come from the High North. And we have to take into account that China's intentions for this region are not transparent. And it has to be seen also in the light of a broader and deepening strategic relationship between China and Russia. NATO allies will continue to deter aggression, protect our values and interests, and keep our people safe. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Others who want to put questions, please put your hands up so the people can bring the microphone to you so we can don't have to wait for it. Please.
Thank you. My name is Andriy Gladi, and I'm from Ukraine, and I currently work in Iceland. Mr. Admiral, thank you for your speech. And in your recent speech, you had mentioned that Ukraine had transformed the modern warfare. And this is an undeniable fact. So therefore, my question is, what did NATO learn following this war? And what instruments could be implemented to prevent or to oppose I would say hypothetical private military campaigns activities in the Arctic. We also can deny this fact, for instance. And I would just would like to comment.
This is for questions. Let him answer, please. Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
thank you.
How long do we have? So I think in terms of the war in Ukraine, some lessons are also lessons for NATO. One of the big differences between a war where NATO is involved and a war where Ukraine is involved, that NATO has a much stronger air force. So some of the things that Ukraine has to do now, in the particular way in the counteroffensive, is understandable given the fact that you do not have a very strong air force against the Russians. So that makes actually the progress in the counteroffensive so much more impressive, because the Ukrainian armed forces basically crawled forward in minefields that are 10 kilometers deep and that are having 5 to 6 mines per square meter. And that's how they would then reach the first physical barrier that was put up by the Russians. And then after that, there's another terrain, and then there's a second physical barrier. So Ukraine is moving forward still every day. Sometimes it's 100 meters, sometimes it's a kilometer. They move forward every day. And that means that the Russians lose ground every day. And it's not as fast as the Ukrainians want it to go, but it's the reality of how they have to fight this war. Second, when it comes to other lessons, I think one of the lessons is the use of drones. I think that is one of the lessons that is going to affect probably all the conflicts that we will see in the future. We saw it when Hamas attacked Israel, and how Israel operates in Gaza. Drones are there to stay, and it means basically that it becomes more and more difficult to hide. I think that's the big change. So it becomes more and more difficult to hide, and therefore forces on the ground need to move, to be constantly on the move. A division, which is about 20,000 people, and their headquarters need to move every 3 to 4 days. So that is the new reality. And then your last question with regard to the private military campaign companies, that is a challenge. I don't have a ready answer for it. It's probably, it has to do with what the nations can agree amongst them in the Arctic Council, I would assume, to prevent that from happening.
Can I take you back to the Arctic analysis in your speech? Because you rightly described the growing relationship between Russia and China in terms of energy, the building of the 8,000 kilometers long pipeline from the Siberian part of Russia all the way down to Shanghai, the plans for a second pipeline, maybe India is also interested in a gas pipeline to India, because these large nations needs a lot of energy. So am I correct in understanding you in the way that since these energy mining interests between Russia and China, definitely maybe Russia and some other Asian countries as well, will continue? And as you said, because of the Russian military position in the Arctic and the non-transparency of the Chinese interest, is it correct to conclude from the analysis you were drawing that there will, in your opinion, be a continuous need in the coming years for a defense or military buildup from NATO, the Western side, up in the Arctic?
It's not only because of these energy deals. It is also because of the Russian behavior. I mean, the reason why NATO's posture against Russia changed was because of the Russian behavior. In 2008, they invaded Georgia. In 2014, they annexed Crimea. In 2022, they invaded the rest of Ukraine. That is their behavior, nobody else's. And as a result, NATO has changed its policy with regard to Russia. We tried to work with Russia for 20 years as a partner. We were not interested in having an aggressive relationship with Russia. It was Russia that chose to move in another direction. And their behavior has led to our changed posture and now our refocus on collective defense. The nations in the Arctic are worried. We're talking about 7 out of the 8 nations of the Arctic Council that are a member of NATO if Sweden has joined the alliance, and they are concerned of what happens there. It's the buildup of the Russian infrastructure, military infrastructure, and of course, then on top of that, I talked about the increasing relationship, the strategic relationship between China and Russia, and it is unclear, that's what I said, what the consequences of that for the alliances, for the alliances in the high north. That's what I said.
Okay, I thought there was a question there in the back. Did I see that correctly or not? Yes, there was here in the middle. Yeah.
Oh, there's a gentleman there in the back.
Yes, there in the back, and then there's a question here in the middle of the hall. Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Hi, my name is Gabriel Gaden, and I'm a student in the University of Iceland in political science. So my question is also concerning the war in Ukraine and what's happening right now. Considering the constant evolution of war techniques and war means, to you, Admiral, what should be the focus of Western allies and NATO considering hybrid threats and the new means and ways of war that's happening in the Ukrainian war today? Thank you.
Can we take also the question here in the middle? Yes, please, bring the microphone there. Is that okay?
Yes, fine.
Thank you very much. My name's Bailey Wong. I'm with the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy in the United States. And my question to you, Admiral, is as you mentioned, China's intentions are unclear or uncertain, and the change in policy of NATO towards Russia is based on aggressive behavior, which is observable. And so my question is with regards to China and NATO, in this uncertainty and maybe lack of specific behavior which can be pointed to, is there not room for collaboration or cooperation within this uncertain framework? Thank you.
Let me start with the last one because it is important. NATO describes China as a challenge, not a threat. And therefore, we are concerned. But there is dialogue. I meet every year in Singapore. I meet with a Chinese delegation during the Shangri-La dialogue. And we exchange our concerns with regard to what is happening between China and NATO. And I think that is extremely important to talk to one another. So there is dialogue, also on the political level. But as a result of the war in Ukraine, the political dialogue with Russia died down. Then it was there were two people in NATO on the military side allowed to talk to the Russian chief of defense, General Gerasimov, which is the CMC, that's me, and the Supreme Allied Commander Europe. I've reached out to General Gerasimov now 4 times, and he doesn't want to talk to me. In the beginning, he said he was busy with this special operation and he would soon come back to me. We're now in the 20th month of a 3-day war. And so then the third letter was on that he said, NATO is part of the problem and therefore I won't talk to you. And now the last letter, after the drones that land in Romania as a result of the attacks on the other side of the Danube River in Ukraine, some of these drones drift away and end up in NATO territory. And we want to find out whether that is intentional or not. That's why this mil-to-mil contact is so important, to basically find out, is this your intention to do this, or is it an accident? And if you can find out that it is an accident, then you have a different discussions than when it is intentional. So, I mean, that's the reason why we should have that discussion. Now, I'm not having that discussion with the Chinese. That's not about this type of threat or military interventions. That's not the case. It is on the intentions of China. It is on how they see NATO, how we see China. And I would lie if there's not disagreement on certain issues. One of the topics is, why is NATO interested in Southeast Asia, for example? I would say the same way China is interested in Europe. Chinese frigates came to Baltic Sea in 2017 to participate in the Russian exercise Zapad. They passed through the English Channel. They passed through internationally recognized international waters. So they were not stopped, blocked, harassed in any way. But if NATO allies sail through the Taiwan Strait, for example, they are sometimes being harassed. So there is a difference in approach and how we deal with each other. It's not a NATO-China issue per se, but it is amongst some of the allies. There is sometimes a difference of opinion on how the rules-based international order is to be interpreted. And last year, one of my questions back to the ambassador was also who talked to me first and in response to my speech was about this: is how do we interpret the rules-based international order? And I think that is one of the questions that is on the table for the coming years, because I think in some ways the present set of rules is not to the liking of a number of nations, and that in itself is not a problem if you want to change the rules in accordance with the rules. But if you do it by force, if you do it by might and not through discussions, that's something we shouldn't do. And I think that is part of the discussion. So NATO is not looking at China as a threat. There is dialogue. And I think that is important to continue having that. To the gentleman, Gabriel, in the back, hybrid warfare. For many years, people thought that the new war would be about cyber and drones and artificial intelligence and quantum and sort of a clean war. That's what people thought. And I think actually people hoped that was the way war was going to evolve. For a very long time, a lot of people in politics thought about the world as they wanted it to look like, not necessarily as it looked like. And so I think in terms of how the war is fought in Ukraine, we see on the one hand First and Second World War tactics. The trenches are back. Artillery barrages, 20 to 30,000 artillery rounds per day from the Russians on Ukraine. That's more than 7 million rounds per year. That is what is happening. That is Second World War, First World War. Yes, there is cyber, but cyber has not been decisive. Cyber has not been changing the course of the war. And therefore, we have to be ready for this old war and at the same time be ready for the new war with drones and artificial intelligence, which makes them much more accurate, which makes them much more effective. And that is all happening at the same time. And that makes it so difficult to choose. In most of our nations, politicians and also the industry has focused on efficiency for the last 30 years. Just in time, just enough in the industry. Governments spent as little as possible on anything. And so therefore, it is always on efficiency, not on effectiveness. And if the enemy has a tank, it's probably handy to have a tank as well. So if you choose, you can make the wrong choice. Because if you are attacked, that's what we are focusing on again, collective defense. Somebody can attack us. And therefore, we have to be readier than in the past. We have to be ready to counter that if it comes.
Well, thank you very much, Admiral, for presenting these views so comprehensively and clearly and answering the questions in this way. I hope you also see from not only the packed hall we have here, but also the interest we sense from the audience, that it's a very important part of moving forward to have the opportunity to have this open dialogue. Where, as you know, I didn't have any idea who would ask the questions or what they would ask you about. And as a part of the mission of the Alliance, such an open dialogue and discussion with the representatives of the Arctic communities and those interested in the Arctic in this platform is important for us, then I mean the people in the Arctic, not the Arctic Circle, but I hope the Alliance also finds it important, and I take that from your efforts of being here again. I'm not, like I did last year, putting you under the pressure to return next year as well. I think that would perhaps be too much to ask, although you are always welcome.
If you promise the weather is
better. Yeah, typical the weather. Yes, well, this is the first time the weather has had some disturbing effect on the Arctic Circle.
Climate change, there you go.
Yes, yes, we discussed that during the first day. But this is also the session where we have overrun our time more than any other session during the assembly. We see that here on the screen. I'm not blaming you, but just for the audience. But thank you again very much for coming and being willing to engage in this dialogue and present your view so clearly and systematically as you have. I'm sure there will be a lot of follow-up discussions and thinking from the audience. And we will, as an organization, try to facilitate that dialogue as we move forward. So thank you very much. And we will, of course, be able to welcome you.